This speech was given by Dr. Joel Schwartz of the Harvard Medical School on March the 31st, 2005. It begins with the doctor talking about the killer smog in 1952 in London, England, and ends a bit abruptly due to the time limits given for the congressional staff. This was a briefing for congressional staff, and now you too can know what the government has been told about air pollution.
People in London in 1952 heated their homes with coal. That's not a clean fuel. And now I'm from Boston. You know, they tell me that it was cold, by which they mean that the temperature hovered around freezing. That's not our definition of a cold winter, but in London it is. And it led to a low-level thermal inversion. Okay, so you have this box of air that you're putting pollution into. It's got a lid on the top, which isn't very high. Well, you can still get rid of this stuff by blowing it out of town, but the wind goes to zero. You combine those two things, and this is a plot of the smoke concentration in London. That was the measure they used. And in one day, it shot up by, almost a factor of 10. Okay, so it shoots up, and guess what? The number of deaths per day shoot up. And then the air pollution comes down, and the number of deaths per day come down. But in other cities in England, all of which are north of London, if you think about England for a moment. In other cities of England, it was also what they call cold in England. But they didn't happen to have thermal inversions, and they didn't see this. So this is definitely not, some respiratory epidemic. You also know that because respiratory epidemics actually, an influenza epidemic is 3 to 5 weeks. It's not 3 to 5 days. Right? This is just not the time pattern that we see with influenza. Influenza showed up about 6 weeks later in London. And the change in the number of deaths was extraordinary. It went up fourfold in a day or two. And then it came back down. So we know that sudden excursions in air pollution can kill people. There's just no other explanation for what happened here. Now, on the other hand, smoke isn't the only thing that increased. Sulfur dioxide also increased in London. So how do we know that it's the particles and not the SO2? Well, in 1956, there was another episode in London. And in that episode, the sulfur dioxide concentrations were essentially as high as they were in 52. But the smoke concentrations were much lower. They still went up, but it was, much less for the particles. And in fact, the increase in deaths was much lower. I mean, if that showed you the dose response curve for SO2 in 1952, it was completely inconsistent with 1956. Whereas if it was the smoke, the particles that were explaining that, then this pattern made perfect sense. Later in the 70s, somebody did a study in New York, and they looked at daily fluctuations in particle concentrations in New York, daily fluctuations in sulfur dioxide, and daily fluctuations in how many people died. And they did it winter by winter. And every winter, you could get a slope for particles. More particles, more people died. You get a slope for SO2. More SO2, more people died. But during the 1970s, they introduced rules on the sulfur content of fuels, and there was a dramatic drop in the sulfur levels in New York. But there wasn't a proportionate drop in the particle levels. And every year, the slope they got for particles was about the same. And every year, as the SO2 levels went down, the slope for SO2 kept going up and up and up and up and up. Now, there are two explanations for this. One is that every year, sulfur dioxide got more and more toxic. And the other explanation is that sulfur dioxide and particles went up and down together because they were coming from burning fuel, right? So they were correlated. But one microgram of sulfur dioxide leveraged a lot more micrograms of particles in the end of the 70s than in the beginning because the SO2 levels were going down. So they were still correlated, but particles were going up a lot more for each unit increase in SO2 when the SO2 levels were getting squeezed. And so that too is consistent with it not being the sulfur dioxide, it being the particles. And then in the 90s, someone repeated exactly the same study in the Netherlands, which they treated like one sort of big city. And they saw exactly the same thing. So they did the analysis year by year. For some mysterious reason, the slope for SO2 just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger because the SO2 was going down a lot faster than the particles. It's actually one other reason we know it's not the SO2, and that is because 90% of the SO2 you breathe in is stripped out in your upper airways and doesn't get down your throat. It also doesn't get into your body when you breathe out, which is recommended. Don't just inhale. It goes back out into the air that you're exhaling. And so almost none of it gets absorbed by the body. And so it was really hard to understand how SO2 was doing this when we're really not exposing people to SO2. And there's also like no SO2 in the air to speak of in the United States anymore. So you certainly couldn't explain what we see now with SO2. So there are a lot of reasons to lead to the conclusion that it's not the SO2. There were still some other issues. This is 2,000 micrograms per cubic meter. Okay. The ambient air quality standard for PM2.5, which is the way we measure particles, 24-hour average not to exceed 65 micrograms per cubic meter. That's sort of a different scale, right? So maybe particles are killing people, but only if they get to a really high concentration. And at low concentrations, it doesn't matter. That is to say, maybe the dose response curve comes down and then it levels off. There's a threshold in it, you know. Doesn't matter if you go from 20 to 40. It only matters if you go from 420 to 440. Was that a question? No. Okay.
So just for reference, so like, fortunately we don't have them anymore, but the smoke-filled room or the smoking part of the airline, airplane cabin, what would be the...
Oh, the smoking, right. Back when you were on that airplane, when people were smoking, yeah, that's probably several hundred, 200-300 micrograms per cubic meter on the airplane. Now, if they were smoking cigars in the smoke-filled room back in the 1880s, it could have been more than that. But for cigarettes, it's in that order. Yes?
One of the other things that often occurs in these situations is that you don't just get smoke, but you get smog. And so there's a fog or water component to it. And I don't know what happened in this particular event, but can you comment on that? So if you're breathing in these little particles, which are not just particles, but are actually wet particles, and therefore coat the lungs more.
Okay, good point. Right. Comes as a surprise to most Americans to know that the word smog means smoke plus fog. Because Americans call ozone smog. They call ozone smog because smog as a phenomena has been described since the 1800s. And then in Southern California, we sort of developed this new kind of air pollution. And they didn't know what to call it for a while. I mean, they could call it ozone, but they figured nobody knew what that was. But the word smog had penetrated consciousness. So they said, well, let's call it photochemical smog. Well, you can guess how long that lasted. So no one, and can you see the newspaper headline writers, you know, using up that much space? So it became smog, and now we use the word smog to mean ozone. But smog means smoke plus fog. And this was a smog event. I mean, in 1952, people pulled their cars over to the side of the road and got out and walked because they couldn't see. They were afraid of hitting somebody or something, right? Visibility was that bad. If you've spent any time in London, a wonderful town, where, as far as I can tell, prices are exactly the same as they are in the United States. They're just denominated in a currency that costs twice as much. In addition to the high prices, you will notice that there is no fog in London. Because in fact, the particles served as the nuclei on which the water condensed and formed that smog. And now it still rains all the time, but they don't have fog because they don't have those nuclei of particles to form it. So these were wet particles. However, many of the things on combustion particles are in fact water soluble anyway. We have a lot of partially complex transition metals, iron, various nickel, things like that on the surface. There are various, you know, organic compounds and stuff like that. And there's also developing evidence that particles themselves induce toxicity because, this is getting real technical, but So there are metals. The point of those metals is they catalytically generate chemicals that produce oxidative stress, that produce inflammation, damage cells, okay? And they do it catalytically, so you can produce a lot of it. They engage in these certain chemical reactions called Fenton reactions that just generate these things called hydroxyl radicals. In addition, if the particle gets down into the part of the lung where you breathe, the alveolar region, you know, the only way you can get things out of there is we have these little macrophages that run around and eat things. And so when they eat the particle, they then try to kill it. And the way, because they think it's a germ, right? That's, you know, what they're there to defend against. And the way we kill things is with chemical warfare, right? And so they generate all these inflammatory chemicals to kill this thing that's in there, and they leak out. And so you get inflammation inside the lung. So I don't think the water affected that much the toxicity of the chemicals. It may have affected the deposition because they grew in size, however. But yeah, these were definitely wet particles. So coming back to, is there a threshold? So we did this study, and we fit these sort of complicated nonlinear curves that had the flexibility to take any shape they wanted in six different cities, and then we averaged those curves across these six cities using some statistical methods we invented. And this is a plot of the dose response curve we see between percent increases in daily deaths and PM2.5 concentrations, and this looks indistinguishable from linear. We don't see any evidence of a threshold. And while this shocks toxicologists, it makes perfect sense to population scientists. Because imagine that there are many, that people do have different susceptibility to air pollution. Okay? Imagine there are a lot of things that might affect your susceptibility. Genes might affect your susceptibility, and I'll show you a slide at the end of this talk of one. Whether or not you have diabetes may affect your susceptibility. whether or not you currently have a respiratory infection may infect your susceptibility, right? Now imagine, so I have a distribution in the population of all of these different factors that affect how susceptible you are. And so there's a distribution of how high the concentrations have to get before they cause some serious event in you. Now we have this wonderful thing in statistics called the central limit theorem. And once you have about eight things that you're adding up the distributions of, it doesn't matter what the distribution of the original eight things look like. The sum of them is going to look normal. And so that means that we would expect the dose response curve between air pollution and daily death to be a cumulative normal curve. On the other hand, air pollution doesn't actually kill, 40% of the population on a given day. It kills, 1% of the population given day. It's small. We're down in the low end of that dose response curve. And if you just do the math, the low end of a cumulative normal curve is linear. Right? It's almost mathematically impossible for this not to have happened. Try telling that to a rat poisoner. Now, the other possibility, though, is that these people who died on December 6, 1952 in London would have died anyway on December 10th. These people were, on their last legs. They were dying of cancer. They were dying of pneumonia. They were sitting in the hospital. They were going into, their breathing was getting pretty, irregular. And so you bump them off today. But, they weren't going to be around very long anyway. If that's true, this doesn't matter very much. Except in Florida. But here's another graph of that same event, which goes out a little longer. And what you can see is, yes, the deaths came down, but not to where they started. It came down fast initially, and then there was this sort of long, slow tail of declining over a couple of weeks to get back to baseline. And that's been seen in every big air pollution episode ever observed. Instead of fewer people than expected dying the next week, more people than expected died the next week. There's a little bit of a lag. There are some people who seem to be affected and die right away, and then there are some additional deaths that accumulate over the next couple of weeks. And in fact, we did a study in 29 cities in Europe, and we, fit these models that looked out for 40 days, to see what happened. And it just doesn't go negative. We have this long tail, and then eventually it dies down. But it's not true that these people are dying a few days or a few weeks early. And there's another way we can tell that. Because suppose it was true. So air pollution goes up, people die a few days earlier. Well, now, suppose I compare a town with high air pollution to a town with low air pollution. And I ask, what does that do to life expectancy in those towns? The answer would be nothing detectable, right? It would go down by a few days, right? You wouldn't see anything. But in fact, in the six city study, we recruited people in the 1970s in six U.S. cities, followed them for 15 years, got information on individual risk factors, hypertension, diabetes, obesity, controlled for them, and then looked at how the mortality rate in each city compared to the mortality rate in the cleanest city. So you just took the ratio. And the more air pollution, the higher the mortality rate. And this is actually, 26% higher. You can't do that if people are dying 2 days earlier. In fact, if you take this and turn it around and ask, what's the difference in life expectancy between the cleanest town and the dirtiest town? It's 2 years.
What city is that for?
Steubenville, Ohio. Madison, Wisconsin. A lot of beer, not that much particles. 2 years. What was that?
How do you rule out the beer?
How do you rule out? Well, beer is good for you in moderation.
Really good.
But that moderation is not what we associate with college students. Put 2 years in perspective. If we cured cancer, and this new pill, it cures cancer, the average life expectancy in the United States would go up by about 4 years. 2 years is it what?
The prison Steubenville's in the Ohio River Valley.
Yes, it's in the Ohio River Valley, and it had, in addition to being near all those coal-burning power plants, there's a steel mill in Steubenville, and another one, actually two steel mills, one on each side of the river. Coke ovens, all sorts of attractive things. Also, Frank Spicer's wife came from Steubenville, Ohio, so when they were looking for a dirty city to include in the study, she said, Frank, I got one for you. I remember.
But Joel, is some fraction of mortality also malignancy? This percent increase?
This is all cause mortality, but it turns out...
Is some of it malignancy?
Some of it is lung cancer. There's no signal in any other malignancy except lung cancer, at least that we can detect. Now, there's only 8,000 people, you know. But the only cancer signal we can see is lung cancer.
And what fraction of the total would be lung cancer?
Would be the lung cancer, not that much. It's mostly heart disease, which is an interesting point. But just let me finish this. So put this, if I inverted this and said, well, how many extra deaths per year are we talking about? We're talking about like 250,000 extra deaths a year. In the United States. Forget about calculating the number in China. 250,000 deaths a year in the United States. Right, so that's more than AIDS, plus breast cancer, plus prostate cancer, plus colon cancer put together. It's not lung cancer yet, but we're getting there. It's a big deal. So, of course, it's a big deal. People don't want to do it, a lot about it, and so that leads to a lot of criticism that came up. One of which was that it's just not true. We just faked this. I'm serious. I mean, and this was like, you know, presented at Senate hearings and things like that too. I mean, and so in fact, we had to have the Health Effects Institute A, validate all the data and reconstruct the database, and then pay someone else to reanalyze it to show that they got the same results. And do you know where the data you collected in 1975 is, Jim? This was not easy. I mean, they wanted to go back to the original paper, you see, not to the computer files. Well, you know, finding the papers from 1975 is, well, we had them, but it was, you know, some effort. The other argument is that, you know, okay, people are dying, but they're not dying as this. They're dying because it's hot out, or they're dying because of some other pollutant that some other industry produces, not my industry. And depending on what your industry was, you had different favorites for what that other pollutant might be. Another argument was, give me a break. You know, how are these particles in the air causing people to die, particularly when you tell me most of them are dying of heart disease? Lung, at least, you know, particles go into the lung. What has this got to do with the heart? But one way to subsume all of these questions is to say that they turn out to be the assertion that if we actually change the particle concentrations in the air, we'd be wasting our money because health would not improve. Nothing would happen. So you can test these things piecemeal, or you could test this. So let me show you how you do that. How do I know these people are really dying from particles? So I'm going to give you a brief class in epidemiology. You've probably heard the word case control study. A case control study is where we take someone who's a case. In our case, they died, right? And then you want to have a control. And the hypothesis is if blah increases your risk of dying, then on average, cases will have more blah than controls. Of course, cases and controls may differ on more things than just blah, so you need to either choose the controls to match on those other things, or also measure those other things and control for them statistically. But that's how you do a case control study. Are you with me so far? Okay. Now, I'm going to do an exceptionally tricky case control study because I want to match on as many things as possible. So for my control for Joe Blow, who died today, sorry, I am going to choose as my control Joe Blow on another day when he didn't die. And with the exception of the people in the defibrillated discharge study that I will show you in a few slides, most people only die once. So it's actually not hard to come up with a day when Joe Blow didn't die, right? And that means if I choose that day close in time to the day that he did die, then, you know, his age is the same. Hopefully his sex is the same, you know, his weight is the same, his blood pressure, his cholesterol, whether or not he has diabetes. I mean, all of the things you think of as risk factors for dying are sort of the same between you today and you last week. In addition, if I choose you last week as the control, it's also the same season of the year, right? I mean, I don't have to worry about controlling for season. So by matching close in time to the same person, I can construct a really terrific control where almost nothing else changes between day to day except maybe the air pollution and the temperature. And then, so I pick this time close so I can control for season, and we figured out how to do that. And then I can do an even better trick. I can say, well, it doesn't have to be, I don't care if it's last week or 2 weeks ago. I mean, as long as it's reasonably close. And I can search out the last couple of weeks and find a day that had the same temperature as today. And if the temperature on the control day and the temperature on the event day are the same, then differences in temperature cannot explain whether you're a case or a control, because there aren't any differences in temperature. Or I could pick a day in the last couple of weeks that had the same SO2 concentrations. I probably can't do both the temperature and another pollutant, but you can do them one at a time. And so that's exactly what I did. I matched on temperature, or on carbon dioxide, or on ozone, or on nitrogen dioxide, and you always see an association between daily deaths and particles. And so it can't be because you didn't control for obesity, and it can't be that you didn't control for the same month, and it can't be that you didn't control for temperature, because they're the same. So we can really rule that out. But that still leaves the puzzling question of how can this be happening? And so one way to try to figure that out is to start by asking, what are they dying from? And then, well, what increases your risk of dying from those diseases? And see if we can sort of put something together. So here's what they're dying of. This is from a study I did in Philadelphia in 94. So this is comparing high air pollution days to low air pollution days. And you have about a 7% increase in total deaths. About an 11% increase in people who died at outside a hospital. And a 21% increase on dead on arrival deaths. Now how do you get to be dead on arrival? You die quickly. And how do you, and in modern America, how do you die quickly? You have a heart attack or an arrhythmia. Sudden death is primarily heart attacks and arrhythmias. So that says, maybe we should think about heart attacks and arrhythmias. What's going on there?
Or automobile accidents.
Or, but actually we excluded those. These are, the term of art is non-external causes of death. So gunshot wounds, traffic accidents, plane crashes, not in here. Well, arrhythmias. Arrhythmia, talk to this man about arrhythmia. He'll tell you all about arrhythmia. No? Arrhythmias is when the beating of the heart becomes incoherent. You know, all the muscles are not pumping together because the electrical signals that stimulate the contraction of these muscles are supposed to start up here and spread out, and they don't, okay? And so that often leads to sudden death. Well, there are some people who are diagnosed to be at high risk of having arrhythmia and dying. And so they have what the vice president likes to call a pacemaker plus, but it's not. They have a defibrillator implanted in their body. You know those things with the paddles to shock the heart into starting beating again the right way? They've got it. What they've got is wires that monitor their electrocardiogram continuously. They've got a battery and a capacitor that can be charged up. And when it detects an abnormal rhythm of the kind that looks like it's turning into ventricular tachycardia, ventricular fibrillation, whack. So we had these people who die for us multiple times, which is very thoughtful of them, and get shot back to life by their implanted defibrillator. So we went to the defibrillator clinic, you know, at Beth Israel Hospital, and these people come in every 3 to 6 months and they wave a wand over their chest and download all the data about what's been happening to them in the last 3 months. So we know the date and the hour of when these defibrillators went off. Yeah, and most of these people, they didn't go off, but some of them, they did, and some of them they went off a fair amount of time. And there were 6 patients who had at least 10 events over, you know, a 3-year period. And so we looked at those people. And, you know, their defibrillator was more likely to go off on high particle days. It was even stronger if we looked at black carbon and NO2, which are markers of traffic particles. Diesel particles. So, and this has been repeated, and we've also done studies where we put portable electrocardiogram devices, which are about the size of an iPod now, an iPod with a few extra wires, and we put them on people and we have them wear them, and we can see changes in their electrocardiogram patterns that are risks for developing arrhythmia going up and down with the particle concentrations in the air. So, maybe something really is going on with arrhythmic deaths.
Do you have interviews with the patients about things such as stresses or other things that you're not going to be able to read with ECGs?
No, we couldn't talk to these people. So this is just passive data. We're trying to start up a study where we will talk to people, and as long as we're talking to them, we're going to, you know, suck their blood as well. Learn all sorts of interesting things from that. But these weren't our patients. We could get this data, but we
could. Could you say something about the age distribution of
them? 50s to 70s, I would guess, but I don't remember actually. But that's typically where we get these patients. Now, how could that be? That says, yeah, it is plausible that we're causing sudden death. We have another slide looking at heart attacks, where we did interview the people, actually, in the ICU 24 hours after their heart attack. And this is, in fact, the famous study that discovered that, you know, snorting cocaine increases your risk of having a heart attack. Having sex increases your risk of having a heart attack. There were all these questions about what you were doing in the 2 hours before the symptoms started. And then, because we had hourly measurements of air pollution, we could match to that, and we saw an association between air pollution and heart attacks. But that, we had the interviews and stuff, the defibrillator study, we didn't. Oxidative stress is, you know, almost the new mantra of medicine, right? I mean, there are no diseases that are not partially caused, totally caused, or at least exacerbated by oxidative stress, which is to say that very oxidizing compounds get produced all the time in your body. It's part of natural physiologic processes, and there are feedback controls on it to keep it from getting out of hand. Those feedback controls aren't so good that they allow you to live forever, however, because, you know, evolution isn't really very interested in your living forever. But they do keep you alive long enough to have kids. And there are lots of disease states, like weighing too much, which produce increased oxidative stress in all sorts of organs all over the body, and that seems to be associated with lots of bad things, like atherosclerosis, like diabetes. I mean, all sorts of diseases are related to oxidative stress. So this is a study that was done at the school where they took live animals, rats, put them in a chamber, exposed them to air that we sucked off of the road going by the school. You know, we just took air out of the window, concentrated up the particles in the air and filtered out the gases, and exposed the rats in a chamber to urban particles in Boston, which is a pretty clean city, unless you live in Scandinavia, in which case it's not such a clean city. And as the time of exposure of these rats increased, there was little fiber optics got inserted into them, and there's this neat little assay where you can actually make, you know, put in these chemicals that fluoresce when they hit these oxidative chemicals. And so you can do a measure of how much oxidants there are in the body real time with fluorescence. Okay, and this is a measure of how much oxidants there were in the lung with increasing hours of exposure and in the heart. And you can see that not only did compounds increase in the lung, which was sort of obvious that would happen, but what was not obvious is that oxidative compounds are increasing in the heart as well within hours as you're getting exposed. Living animals. So particles do produce oxidative stress. Oxidative stress is well established as a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. In particular, inflammatory processes associated with oxidative stress increase the risk that plaques in your arteries rupture, and that's what triggers a heart attack. Well, that's interesting. And you've got, as I said, defenses in your body against oxidative compounds. They're called antioxidants. Probably the primary intracellular antioxidant in your body is glutathione. Glutathione is one of the major defenses against oxidative compounds. There are a number of other things called glutathione transferases, which link up with the glutathione and help it react with these oxidative compounds to detoxify them. And these glutathione transferases also have antioxidant behavior of their own. There are a number of them, which is good, because one of them, glutathione S transferase M1, half the population doesn't have the gene that makes this enzyme. So I took a study that we have ongoing in Boston called the Normative Aging Study. People who have been followed since the 70s, and they're now in their 70s. And we hooked up these portable electrocardiogram monitors to them, and we looked at a measure of how their heartbeat was being controlled. We looked at the variability of the time between heartbeats. And you want your heart to vary the time between heartbeats. You don't want a metronome. Okay, so more variability is good. It's controlled by two parts of the nervous system, the parasympathetic and the sympathetic nervous system. But short-term changes in heart rate variability are driven by the parasympathetic nervous system because the neurotransmitters that produce the sympathetic response hang around for a few seconds. I mean, you can't get rid of them real fast. So the very high frequency component of heart rate variability is driven by the parasympathetic nervous system, which happens to be the nervous system that includes all of the neural receptors in the lung, including a bunch of irritant receptors that could plausibly get stimulated by irritating things going on in the lung. And sure enough, we see a 37% reduction in the high frequency component of heart rate variability, which is the part driven by the parasympathetic nervous system, for a 10 microgram change in PM2.5 in Boston. If you don't have the gene to make glutathione S transferase M1. But if you do have the gene, nothing happens. So clearly, the effects on cardiac rhythm have something to do with the oxidative stress produced by the particles, because differing amounts of ability respond and cancel out oxidative stress lead to differing susceptibility.
Do people without the gene have lower lifespans?
You know, that's a very interesting question, and this is a sort of small cohort, and so I actually did take a look at that, and it's not statistically significant, but it is a noticeable difference in the life expectancy. So maybe with a few more of them die, we'll have a paper. So I think the answer is yes. Well,
can I ask another question?
Yeah.
Do you know anything about that population? You know, that particular lack of the gene? Is it in Europeans or anything about its distribution?
It's 50% of the Caucasian population in the U.S. is lacking the gene. The statistics on, you know, blacks and Asians aren't as good, so maybe a little different than that, but it's not grossly different. So that leaves us with the question, if I want to buy reductions in particles, what particles do I want to buy? Now, this is a NASA photograph of the Northeast. And I want to point out that this white stuff here is clouds. But this stuff underneath it is not a cloud. That's a fine particle aerosol haze. Those are particles. East coast of North America is blanketed with particles in the summer. And in the summer, almost half of those particles are sulfates. They're long-range transported particles from the power plants in the Midwest. And you don't need an air pollution monitor. You can see it from space. Yes, sir.
They're not particles that are emitted from power plants. It comes from sulfur dioxide.
That's right. They're secondary particles.
And the sulfur dioxide is oxidized and then forms this little sulfate.
That's right. So they're ammonium bisulfate particles predominantly. They're formed by the secondary reaction of the sulfur dioxide emitted by the power plants, which is an important point that we'll come back to.
It means that they can be carried farther away from the power plant because they start off as a gas.
Exactly.
They don't get washed out necessarily as easily in that first phase.
Right, they start out as a gas. They also can travel.
Particulates fall out very quickly. Particulates you don't find, that are emitted directly, do not transport far away from the planet.
Well, depends on the size. Submicron particles will transport pretty far. But one of the problems we clearly have are sulfate particles, unless, of course, we think they're not bad for you. But that's one of the major sources of particles in our air.
In fact, they're pervasive.
They're right. I mean, and you know, I didn't put it in here, but I have a similar picture of China. You know, and there are parts that, I mean, here, you know, the ground is a little obscured by this haze. You take this same picture of China, and there are parts of China where you cannot see the ground. You know it's down there, but, you know, I mean, it's much thicker.
So can you just make a clarification? It's a little confusing because before you were talking about sulfur dioxide really not being associated with the health, but this is sulfur dioxide turning
right
into PM2.
Exactly. Sulfur dioxide gas itself doesn't seem to have much health effects, but sulfur dioxide is a major precursor of particles. In fact, most of the particles in our air are not primary particles. Not only are the particles that we get from power plants, particularly since we now have these filters on the power plants, almost all secondary particles formed by chemical reactions in the air. But many of the particles we get from motor vehicles are secondary particles also, and particles from other sources. So we have a lot of secondary organic carbon particles in the air as well. So one of the problems was, you know, people, you know, if you're interested in lead, you want to know how much lead they're pumping out into the air. But if you're interested in particles, the amount of primary particle emissions, you know, is only a small part of the story. I mean, a medium part of the story, but, you know, the bulk of the story is actually in secondary particles and understanding them. So we did this study in those same six cities where we sort of looked at long-term survival. We also looked at day-to-day changes in air pollution and day-to-day changes in how many people died. But because we had collected the particle measurements in those cities, we had daily filters on which we collected particles in each city, and we analyzed them for 20 different elements. And using that, we could, with various factor analyses, statistical techniques, separate out different sources of particles in those cities and estimate how much of the mass in the air was coming from resuspended dust. So silicon and aluminum, sands and clays. This data was back in the 70s and early 80s, and there was still lead and gasoline, so it was pretty easy to get a traffic particle signature. You know, selenium and sulfur were you know, tend to associate with coal particles, and you really only get vanadium from burning residual oil, and even only really from Venezuelan residual oil has significant amounts of vanadium. So anyway, this is just to show you there are different elements that tend to associate with different particles. And so by analyzing all of these things every day on every filter, we can get an estimate of how much particles were in the air from each source on each day. And we looked at the simultaneously the effect of all of them, controlling for the other ones, predicting daily deaths. And what we saw was there was really nothing going on with the crustal particles. There was an increase in mortality associated with the particles from the coal-burning power plants. There was a somewhat larger increase associated with motor vehicle particles. The biggest increase was actually from the residual oil particles, but there were so few of them. And basically, outside of Boston, you know, we didn't have very much of this. So it's hard to see, but the confidence interval is very big and includes zero. But animal toxicology studies of residual oil fly ash suggest that it is extremely toxic, more toxic than average. So that may actually be true, but we don't have a lot of it in there. So we saw signals that all of the combustion particles looked like they were toxic, but you know, wind-blown dust looked relatively benign in these cities. This is a study that's coming out next month in Circulation. We looked at diabetics in Boston. And there's a test you can do on diabetics, which is highly predictive of cardiovascular mortality. And it's a measure of how well, endothelium is just the fancy name for the lining of the blood vessels, okay? How well your blood vessels perform. And one of the things blood vessels have to do is they have to relax and they have to constrict, you know, under different circumstances. They're not supposed to be rigid pipes. And diabetics don't do this as well as non-diabetics. One of the reasons why diabetics die more of heart disease is damage to their blood vessels. So there's a measure which basically consists of, you put on like a blood pressure cuff and you know, blood doesn't flow to your fingers, right? So after a while, your fingers sort of really want to see some blood, right? And so if you release the blood pressure cuff, the blood vessels dilate. They expand so blood can start pumping through fast because there's demand from your body for some oxygen to start flowing down there. And you can measure how much the arteries expand with ultrasound. And so you do this ultrasound measurement of how much the arteries expand. And that, you want a big number. The bigger the number, the longer you're going to live. Okay? Well, what we saw was that both black carbon particles, which is a good tracer in Boston for traffic particles, there's nothing else that makes black particles except burning gasoline and diesel oil, and sulfate particles were both associated with significant decreases in the ability of these blood vessels to relax. And they were independently associated because they were basically uncorrelated with each other. So we see that both the sulfate particles from the coal-burning power plants and the traffic particles were associated with this physiologic response that's a risk factor for heart disease. So the answer is traffic particles and power plant particles both seem to be important. And there are other sources of particles, but I'm running out of time. Let's come to the bottom line and ask, what happens if I actually reduce the particles in the air? If the answer is nothing, then, you know, somehow I pulled the wool over your eyes someplace upstream, right? And it's not really bad for you. Well, the largest leverage buyout in history was when West Germany bought East Germany in 1990. And Hettstedt, Bitterfeld, and Zerbst are three towns in what used to be East Germany, and they used to be pretty dirty. And one of the things that happened in East Germany was it cleaned up fast. And so 3 years after the wall came down, particle concentrations in Hettstedt had dropped from 80 to less than 40. And particle concentrations in Bitterfeld had dropped substantially, and in Zerbst. So what people in the German version of the National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences did is they went in right after the wall came down and they looked at the prevalence. They recruited a sample of school children in all of these towns. They collected data from their parents and from them, and they found out what fraction of those children had bronchitis that year. And they controlled for parental smoking and things like that. And then they went, and here's the plot, and they published this. And they said, gee, the more polluted town has more bronchitis. That's kind of interesting. Also interesting was the fact that the rates of bronchitis in children in Germany were astronomical. My kid never had bronchitis. Well, 3 years later, they went back and they looked at kids the same age, so it's a new generation of kids, and guess what? In Hettstedt, Bitterfeld, and Zerbst, a lot fewer kids had bronchitis the same age 3 years later. And the air pollution had come down. And the same came drifted down a little bit more 3 years later. And you can see, reduce the air pollution, reduce the rate of bronchitis in school children. They also looked at lung function. You take the deepest breath you can and then you blow out as hard as you can, and we measure how much air comes out in 1 second. That's a good measure of how well your lungs are working. And back when these towns were polluted, this was the average blood lung function in these kids. And as the pollution went down, their lung function went up. And this is, again, controlling for parental smoking, controlling for what kind of heating they do at home, controlling for family history of asthma and things like that. They can see lung function increases when they reduce the air pollution, the particles. Now, East Germany is kind of dirty, but Switzerland was kind of clean in the 90s. Ever been to Switzerland? Nice place. Okay. This is from a survey that's done in Swiss schools in a bunch of communities in Switzerland, again, over two time periods. And what you see here is the change in the prevalence of dry cough at night, which is an asthmatic symptom. And over there is the change in PM10 concentrations, in particle concentrations. And though, with the exception of Lugano, which looks a bit of an outlier, the bigger the change in PM concentrations, the bigger the drop in nocturnal dry cough. Lower the particle concentrations, and asthmatic symptoms in children go down. And this is looking at, scaled for a 10 microgram change, just so you can look at different symptoms. You also see it with chronic cough. You also see it with bronchitis. There's a 40% reduction in bronchitis rates in Switzerland if you bring particle concentrations down by 10 micrograms per cubic meter. And, you know, a little less convincing with wheeze, and for prevalence of asthma, there's no change. So it's more the symptoms. But significant change, and it's a little less convincing for NO2. It looks more like the particles. Lower the particles, lower the rates of illness in children. And now let's come back to the six city study 10 years later. So we went back and we followed these people for another 10 years. And we looked at the additional risk of dying in the next 10 years. But a funny thing happened in Steubenville, Ohio. The air pollution concentration was cut in half. And in St. Louis, there was a significant drop. Whereas in, you know, Madison, Wisconsin, it didn't change much. And as the air pollution concentrations fell, the risk of dying fell in those cities. Death. You lower the air pollution concentration and people live longer.
Is that the closing of the steel mills?
Partly it's the closing of the steel mill, yeah, and partly it's pollution controls getting put on in the 80s. And that's why, you know, not so much happens in Madison, Wisconsin. They started low, it's hard to get that much lower. But when we cleaned up cities, their mortality rates fell. And if we didn't, they didn't. So the last thing, there was a ban on the use of coal for domestic heating in Dublin in 1990. And it was a 13% reduction in cardiovascular mortality from one winter to the next. So we're talking about something whose mortality impact is on the order of half of cancer, right? Now, if I told you that I had a pill that could cure half the cases of cancer in the United States, and we were going to phase it in over a 15 to 18 year period, you would lynch me. Now, every coal-burning power plant built since 1979 has had a scrubber on it to remove the SO2 gas that turns into the sulfates. We know how to do this. With the 1990 acid rain bill, a bunch of power plants that had been built earlier retrofitted scrubbers. We know how to do that. And it takes 18 months to build a scrubber. Not 18 years. So you want me to talk about clean air interstate rule versus clear skies, but I want to know how, you know, unlike cancer, we know how to cure this. It's an existing technology. Why are we giving people so much time to put it on? And we know how to make particle filters for diesel engines, the other half of the equation. And in London, at the end of this year, they will have retrofitted every single existing bus, and they have 7,000 diesel-powered buses in London with a particle filter.